Today is Thursday. It is March 16th, 2017, and the time is 11:14 a.m. This is John Williams, and this is another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals. Portions of this can be heard on my Saturday morning show on WGN Radio.
I'm Steve Bertrand, the host of The Business Lunch at noon on 720 WGN.
I'm Scott Stantis, editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune and creator of the Prickly City podcast.
I'm Eric Zorn, the cheeky columnist from the Tribune. It appears Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays in the paper.
Krista McQuarrie frequently joins us in this, your colleague guys, Eric and Scott, but she can't join us today. Scott, we appreciate you coming in here. President Trump has said, okay, here's what my budget proposal is. As I understand, it was written in an interesting way. They culled his speeches and said, well, here's what he was talking about, and therefore that's what he wants. And so what would that budget look like? And it's heavy on defense spending, security, Homeland Security, for instance, and then everything else gets cut. Thumbs up, everybody. What are we thinking, Scott?
I think there are parts of it that make a lot of sense. There's a lot of duplication and overlap. I mean, you know, those are the things you want to get rid of. But then there are other things that you just kind of go, wow, really? Because that's kind of a good thing. I think we're going to probably disagree on what's good and what's bad.
I think it's interesting the point you brought up where in Mulvaney, the budget director, said that I went through his scripts. I took what he wanted. His defense of it or his justification of it, supporting of it, he's not saying this is good for the country. He's not saying this is a great thing for us. This is what we need to do. He's like, well, this is what he said we were going to do, or this is what he said we should do.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a fine I don't know if there's something there or not. But
Mulvaney,
it's just different.
He was surprisingly tepid about that. I heard him interviewed this morning on Morning Joe, and he was, you know, going on about, yeah, he went through the speeches, pulled out things that Trump said, but this is been a constant theme for them lately. It's like, well, this is what we said we were going to do. First of all, he didn't say that he was going to cut Meals on Wheels. I mean, he didn't say a lot of the things, you know, we were going to cut after school programs. He was talking really broadly and generally about waste. And when people are going to see what his idea of waste is, I think they're going to be shocked and angered by this budget proposal.
I'm just surprised that they didn't sit him down and ask him, why do you have to cull his speeches? He's right there. Tell him to stop tweeting for a minute and just tell us what are your priorities.
Yeah, he has to stop watching Fox and tweeting and maybe look at the budget. This is a polar opposite of what I've been advocating for years. There's a great biography out of all people, Calvin Coolidge. And Calvin Coolidge, every day of his administration, work day of his administration, took an hour or three to sit down with the Secretary of the Treasury and go line by line through the budget. I mean, this guy, to the point where it'd say, you know, the Department of the Interior is spending too much on postage. That's a true story.
Yeah.
I mean, he was that immersed in that. It's not sexy. It's not interesting. It's frankly quite boring. But it's also a great way to govern.
Yeah, but
and this
maybe
is the polar opposite.
I guess, but is it necessary? Do you really want your president to line item postage costs for the federal government? I'd rather somebody else do that. Right? If he's doing that, then he can't actually think about China.
He won't have time to watch Hannity every night.
You guys know what I mean, that's probably not
the best
use of his time. No,
you're right. It's too much micromanaging. You're right. You're right, John. But another thing that came up in this discussion this morning where they were talking about, one of the themes that they've been hitting with their cuts is, well, I can't ask the steel worker in Ohio to pay for the corporation for broadcasting.
That's the mantra.
After school. That's their mantras over and over again. We can't ask working people to pay for these programs. But he's asking working people to build a damn wall on the border that we don't need, and that when we have negative, you know, net migration from Mexico, he wants to, you know, they're asking to build a lot of weapons that we're going to be spending a lot of money on that we arguably don't need because they're fulfilling regional interests for congressmen and senators. So, you know, the idea that the test is whether you can ask a steelworker in Ohio to pay for it is just nuts.
Oh, I was going to say that the point I think we're all missing here on this budget, and you mentioned the wall, infrastructure, defense spending. What do these do? These are government boondoggles that hire a crap ton of people. And that's exactly the direction he's taking. We haven't seen the infrastructure. That's not in programs, right? The trillion-dollar-plus infrastructure programs aren't included in this budget. That's, again,
no, those would be more tax cuts for the wealthy to pay for those, too.
Sure. Well, you know, that's how things work, right? You subtract money, then you have it to spend.
Isn't, though, a general theme of this, don't most Americans, even Democrats, agree that in principle, we spend too much money in this country. Government is too big. And golly, here's a guy who said, I'm going to cut, and he's cutting.
Okay, so here's one. The Great Lakes Restoration Project, I'm not sure the exact term. The federal government has spent, it's spent $2.2 billion over the past several years fighting Asian carp, fighting toxic harbors, trying to restore the habitat of the Great Lakes. That's probably money that some guy in Louisiana doesn't think should be spent by the federal government. What do you guys think? I mean,
nobody else will spend that money.
Well,
then
but there's probably bayou restoration programs.
Well, sure, absolutely, absolutely. But I mean, that's a program. I mean, that's regional. That's something the federal government does that is eliminated in this budget.
Well, this is going to jumpstart a really difficult conversation we have, which is, yeah, there is waste, fraud, and abuse in government for sure. But when you ask politicians to cut programs, when you ask them to just like go through and line item things out, you realize suddenly that all of these things have a constituency. Many of them have a purpose, and there's some duplication. There's some things that aren't giving any bang for the buck. But we're seeing this in state government right now as well. And the Democrats have been calling in Republican agency heads down in Springfield to their committee meetings and saying, okay, you're in charge of this committee. Where you're in charge of this agency, where are you going to cut? And they go, hamana, hamana, hamana. They don't know where they're going to cut.
Okay. But if all of these are good ideas, the bayou or the Great Lakes, and everybody's got a constituency, that's a good point. But you have to weigh that against what is the cost in general to us, and that's adding on to the debt, adding on to the deficit.
We're not adding on to the debt with these cuts. We're making these cuts for an equal increase in military spending.
Is it a dollar to a dollar?
It's like $53-54 billion or something.
Okay,
like that.
But if we're committed to $500 billion or $50 billion more in defense spending, which I didn't know we needed that much more defense spending. But if we're committed to that, maybe we do take it from this other area. I mean, that's going to be a cost, right? But just in general, don't you think that we have to consider what the cost is if we don't cut, and that's an increase in debt, in deficit? So weigh the ill of the lake suffering a little bit against the ill of the deficit continuing to balloon out of control. What's the price of that?
I'll answer you after my eyes stop watering because of the pollution in the lakes right now. I can't can't see clearly.
Well, and that was one area of that you can clearly see as they went after the Obama climate change agenda here through all throughout the budget, just obliterates.
Is it a 28% cut in EPA or something?
Yeah, like yeah. That. Okay, how about the Corporation for Public Broadcasting?
I think it should be gotten rid of anyway. I debated this here locally with oh gosh, what was his name? He was the GM for the public radio station here for
Tory Malatia.
Yeah, and he and I debated. I think they should, frankly, because this is I'm going to get in the weeds. Take a second. PBS and NPR both most of the stations are well funded locally.
Sure.
The federal funding is nominal in terms of their general budget.
Really?
Still, yeah, it's a chunk of change. It's still, I forget what the number was, but it's $150 million, but that's spread out through all the whole 50 states. It's less than 2% for most of the NPR stations in America.
I didn't know that.
But except for apparently Central Alaska, where they have to pay for the transmitter stick in the station.
The irony of this is that when you cut Corporation for Public Broadcasting, it's not going to be the WBEZs and the WNYCs and things like that that are going to hurt. It's going to be the stations in Trump country. It's going to be these smaller public radio stations that rely on this funding, and they're going to have to choose.
That his supporters don't listen to.
Well, they might. You know,
boy,
I mean,
that was judgmental piece of crap, wasn't it?
If not accurate, maybe.
I think that it is a significant news source. Public broadcasting for those kind of areas.
Talk about television, though, for a second, Eric. Is the same argument apply to
John Williams wants to kill the big bird? Go ahead.
I think that in this day, look, once upon a time, you had three local TV stations, if you were lucky, an independent. You had the network affiliates. You may have had a Channel 32, and then you had a PBS, and it was important to have those options. I have 1,000 channels on my TV set right now.
Actually,
I don't need to pay for one more.
Well, and in your defense, Big Bird has actually jumped anyway. He's on HBO.
Yeah, and kind of, and he's HBO'd it up a little bit, too.
Well, and that was one of the lines I used in the debate, is that, PBS, if we don't do it, who will? Well, let's see, Discovery Channel, Learning Channel.
It's not as vital as it once was.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would definitely agree with that. I think that you're not going to see a program like Chicago Tonight just spring up out of nowhere, because those things do cost money, but they can be, I believe, listener viewer supported.
Sure.
When it comes to radio, I have to say that there are a lot of excellent podcasts that are even more excellent than this one, maybe, or as excellent, that people can get access to news and information in all throughout the country. But it is important to have some of these local stations covering local events. And funded because of the way newspapers are.
It's funny because I think the four of us are pretty in tune on this one. Let me ask you this, Eric: are those small NPR stations doing that reporting and that covering, or are they, picking up national coverage and throwing the switch? Kind of, because that's my impression more.
I don't know. I don't listen to them. So.
Southern Illinois University of Carbondale, WSIUC, is kind of where I cut my teeth. They're still on the air. They
in
are,
spite of that?
Student-run, largely. I mean, not student-run, but a lot of student reporting. A lot of students actually do very good work there. It's not bad. It's good for that community.
And they rub the nose on the John Williams statue on their way into the studio. So.
What did you guys think of Rachel Maddow's MSNBC expose on Donald Trump's taxes?
This is coming from the conservative in the group here tonight. What a big pile of nothing. She teased it as you would any show, any story. It's the internet age. You put out a tweet saying, hey, we got something really juicy on tonight, even if you don't. So that's how I read it. And I think it's a lot of hubbub over nothing.
I'm a big fan of Rachel Maddow. I watch her or listen to her just about every day. It does irritate me the way any story she takes, she teases out, right? She begins her show with, back in 1923, and she brings the story up to the present day. She puts it in all this context before she tells you exactly what she's talking about. I thought it was an epic fail. It was like...
Really?
Yes.
It was like
the Geraldo Rivera moment. Exactly. She didn't have
There's
anything.
A meme out there with her with her mustache and glasses.
The difference, Eric, was Geraldo didn't know what was in the vault. She knew what she had.
Yeah.
And she still was playing it up that way.
It was two pages of a tax return from 2005. So it was, 12 years old. And the source of it was unknown, but it was a very good tax return for Donald Trump. It showed that he made a lot of money and paid a lot of taxes. Trump feigned indignation or
well, it's standard client copy. You're suggesting that Trump's people played Rachel.
Oh, I think it certainly seemed that way to me. I just thought, and the way she, I think she could have had it as, hey, we got this over the transom, but she teased it for half an hour when she had nothing. Colbert
maybe she should have. Are you suggesting that she should have downplayed the exclusivity and rather said, this doesn't tell the whole story. This is sure they gave this to us.
It was a minor data point at the end of the day. It was the front two pages of a tax return that was 12 years old.
How about this? Here's what we've got, and now here's 30 minutes on why it's not that important. Why we need to see the rest of it.
Yeah,
right?
She didn't do
that. That
might have
been a program.
I disagree with you guys. I think we live in the age of the you won't believe what happened next. Digital age, and that's what she did. I don't think she.
Right, she played it like great drama, but I don't think like real news. I mean, a news editor explained this to me. If she was treating that as a legitimate news item, don't you guys put the most important things at the top of the pyramid? You don't save them for the bottom of the pyramid? If this was really, hey, we've got the goods, it would have been there at the beginning. She would have treated it like a bona fide news item. I don't mind her doing it, though. Look, when they started to investigate Watergate, they didn't really know what they had, and Lord knows their detractors didn't and didn't like that they were doing it. But they just kept churning away. So if you're MSNBC or Rachel Maddow, I say, go ahead and keep doing what you're doing, but you're going to get beat up for doing it because people just don't see the fire yet. It's all smoke.
And the irony was that she had a great story about her in the New York Times earlier in the week about how her ratings are really going up, and she's one of the people who's really benefiting from the Trump era.
Well, don't you think the first half of that show was kind of interesting, where she was spinning that web about how Donald Trump is working with these Russians and these bankers, and one of them bought a house of his that was worth $40 million, and they gave him $100 million, and then they tore it down.
Right.
Well, why would they do that? That must mean something,
right? She's hit on these things. I mean, those of us who follow her know she's hit those stories repeatedly.
That's pretty
recently.
That's good. That's the first time I've ever seen
it. It's good.
Show.
I'm a fan of hers. I just think that she needed to put this into much more context and not overdo it, because she made a fool of herself. I think
she is one of those rare shows now where it is a start to finish show in many ways. Right? I mean, she spins a narrative from the beginning to the end. Whereas I tuned in about halfway in thinking, well, I'll catch up to it. She hadn't built to it yet.
Oh, yeah.
But if it's a typical news show, they're starting with it and there's nothing new. She's telling generally most nights, I don't watch her a lot, but she's telling an hour-long story. Right, Eric? Right? Is that fair?
Oh, often. Yeah. At least her main item, she builds up to it.
She just didn't connect the first and second half to me. She told all of this intrigue. Then she says, now we've got the taxes. And I thought, aha, that's going to explain all of these machinations with the Russians and Trump, and there was no connection
at all.
There's
no connection there at all. And she did explain why we do need to see more of these taxes and why people should care about the tax returns.
I agree.
And she did a good job with that, but she's done that all along.
What was Donald Trump's alias when he was pretending to be a spokesman?
John Miller.
I can just see John Miller sitting in the White House. Rachel, yeah, there's something in your mailbox.
Do you think that she made him more sympathetic, that she actually sort of hurt the cause, if you will?
It was a good story for Donald Trump.
Yeah. I think. A very good story for him. And he also managed to take umbrage at it.
And then he called it fake, even as his administration said it was real, which means now none of us knows what fake news is, because does fake news mean news I don't like, or does fake news mean news that's not true? Evidently, I mean, his administration said that's his tax return. They released it.
Even before she went on the air, they verified it.
Tendercutter, maybe.
In fact, they put out the information so that she no longer had an exclusive on it.
Let's talk a little bit about. Do we want to talk about the ridiculous accusation that Barack Obama tapped Trump's lines?
Well, it's ridiculous because he didn't tap your lines.
There's still new evidence. We don't even know if there's an investigation going on or what the status of that is. I mean, that story remains a tweet that he's doubling down on this week, but it still remains something completely without merit.
Well, the new turn on that story is that they're now claiming that he put the word tap or tapped in quotation marks in some of those tweets. There were four tweets that
only
Saturday
one
morning.
Did he put
was it just one? I thought maybe it was two.
No, there were a couple tweets, but wiretap.
How many times did he use quotes around the word tap? I thought it was once.
But
maybe it's twice.
But then Kellyanne Conway says, well, you know, he's speaking of surveillance in general, like, you know, microwaves with cameras in them, that there's this whole idea that maybe there was some other kind of surveillance.
It's been a good week for Kenmore.
But there is no evidence so far that there's anything to this. And what is so troubling to me about it is that Trump seems to be constitutionally unable to say, I was wrong, I misspoke, you know, I got out ahead of myself. He was interviewed by, who's the guy, Tucker Carlson, the other day, and he was saying that, well, yeah, you know, I saw this on whose show was
Brett Baer.
Brett Baer's show, and then there was something in the New York Times in February or something, and it was just like, he just had nothing.
He was speaking generally, though, about surveillance by the government, what they can do.
Right, and in none of these instances did anyone say Obama ordered wiretapping or surveillance of any sort on Trump Tower. I don't think that's true, and I think that his failure, his inability to say, hey, I got that wrong. And my prediction has been that what he's going to do is come out and say, well, you know what, I cleared this up. I'm so glad.
Which is what he did with the birth certificate.
Right. I mean, he can't even blame other people, right? Some people at least could say, well, this is wrong and it was John's fault. You know, he won't even go that far. He just continues to insist that it might be true, and we're going to provide. He said, you know, yesterday we're going to provide some really interesting things coming up.
He did that when he claimed that he had the biggest electoral college victory since Reagan, and it turned out that he had the second.
Oh, someone told me that.
Oh, his popular and electoral victories are historically marginal. They're close to the bottom.
Right, but someone told him otherwise, and that gave him the excuse.
Yeah, that's right. I heard about that. I go, you heard about it. It's in the newspaper.
So what he does is he says things that are false, that are outrageous, and then his administration spends 3 or 4 days trying to create a truthiness that fits the falsehood. That's what happens, right? I mean, he said he did it by name. He named Obama. He called him sick, called him sad, and then they're saying, well, it wasn't actually Obama, or it wasn't really wiretaps. They have to create this narrative that's just as silly as the one that prompted it all.
Yeah, but you have to wonder, too, if it's I really am starting to think a lot of this is conscious. I'm maybe giving them way too much credit. Look, we're talking about this, you know, and it's just like when the focus starts to go on, say, the Russian connections, that's when he does the Obama is wiretapping me thing. When that goes, you know, belly up, then now we're starting to look at this budget. Then we're going to look at something else. It's every 2 or 3 days. It's really hard to keep up.
And we haven't even mentioned how the health care proposal
House
seems
Budget
to be
Committee
just
approved it today.
Oh, the Republicans
totally
are running away from
going
this
down
fast
the drain.
As
that's
they
a
can.
Huge story.
How do you not have a proposal after 7 years? I'm so furious with Republican friends. I mean, I happen to like Paul Ryan, but you had 7 years to come up with something else, and the best is, yeah, we're just going to make it less. Anything else? No, that's it.
It's basically just a big tax cut for the rich, it looks like to me. I mean, it's not going to improve anybody's health care, I don't think.
It doesn't do anything about costs. It doesn't encourage, which is my position, which is let's really open up the gates and let there be true competition, which will affect costs.
Well, okay, so people bring that up, the marketplace. Let the marketplace deal with it. And I want you to explain this to me.
Sure.
Because I don't understand it, really. I'm a guy who's got, you know, I got carved up last summer, pre-existing conditions. I'm a hard guy to insure. In the marketplace, it's in the insurance company's role to make as much money as they can, right?
Of course.
So they don't want to insure me. I would be a risk for them. I'm not the sort of guy they want to pick up. how do market forces help people like me when it comes to insurance? Seems to me that if you've got no regulation and let just the market dictate it, these insurance companies are going to run away from people who need insurance.
No one, I don't think anyone reasonably is saying you shouldn't have restrictions. I think pre-existing is one that you have to include. But what you can do is have cross-border competition with insurance companies. You can also get creative. For instance, we're a few blocks from one of the best medical centers in America, right, with Northwestern down here. Excuse me. One thing that would be, and smaller towns have tried this approach, and it's worked. You can pay a flat fee or whatever it is, and you're in their system. That means you have access to internists, you know, brainologists or whatever thing they have there.
Brainologists.
But allowing the market, open up the market and allow those types of creative solutions. We haven't done that yet. It may not work. I'm not convinced it will.
Right.
But we have to try that first, and then you can go, and then single payer comes up, and that seems to be the logical.
Or it may be that people like you have to pay a lot more.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
So then, before you had a serious.
But that's the luck of the draw.
But really, that's what I mean when I hear the people say, "Well, we'll let the market forces dictate it, and prices will come down." The rascals are going to make as much money as they can, and they're not going to want to cover people who need to be covered.
Yeah.
What about this idea? And I heard Rand Paul talk about it. About, you know, doing extra state instead of insurance state to state, but forming pools like was early Obama talk, or groups. So like you could join the AARP insurance plan,
yeah,
or some other bigger plan and do it that way. They've got a lot of people. They've got, you know, forces to keep prices down. I mean, what do you guys think of that as a possibility?
I think that's a great idea. Let's see if it works first. And yes, it'll create a patchwork across the United States. I think people tend to like one size fits all, and that's not really practical right now.
Well, do you all agree that it's a right? Should good access to good health care be a right in America, or should that be a privilege? Not everybody gets to drive a Lexus. Some people drive a crappy Chevrolet. Why? Because some people have more money than others. So maybe that's what's going to happen to health care, that if you have more resources, you get better health care, and if you don't, you don't. Too bad.
That will always be true. I think that at some fundamental level, it is a right. And, you know, if you want luxurious healthcare, whatever, single rooms, whatever, you would have extra insurance. And this is how it works in countries with single payer systems, which is you have, you know, a private insurance system on top of a basic national healthcare service, which is where I think we have to end up ultimately.
I think we probably will too, as well. But ultimately, let's give other more creative solutions an opportunity. The alt-right, by the way. That's a great question, John, and it's really at the crux of this entire debate is, does everyone have a right to access to health care?
And I think it's tied to the mandate issue. Go ahead, Scott.
Well, I'm just saying alt-right would answer to the negative. That,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Bertrand, too bad. Why, you know, God obviously hates you and gave you a pre-existing condition, so
no,
you don't get...
No, but I mean, that is the luck of the draw.
I'm being semi-serious
and I think,
on that one.
I think that that's really, if it's by design or not, that'll be the effect. That some people just won't get very good coverage. Some people won't be able to afford it. I mean, a lot of people don't have insurance right now anyway. They're choosing not to.
And that goes back to
what
we're having the same talk.
I don't think people choose not to have, you know, be able to see a doctor when they want, when they're sick, choose not to be able to go to the hospital for treatments. I think that it's a matter of they don't have the money to afford to have the coverage. You know, so, you know, it's put it in terms of like, it's not like a Lexus. This is something that you have to have.
You have access to a Lexus too, by the way.
I do have access to it.
Do you think it should be mandated? Should everybody have
buy? What we're talking about are the things that we talked about in the first go around that I thought were settled law.
Yeah,
people who are insured is better, not just for them, but for all of us, right? The more people who stay healthy, the less we all pay. Healthcare costs were going up at a lower rate after Obamacare than they were before. I mean, there was this idea, you know, if you say it was a disaster and is falling apart often enough, everyone believes it's true. But there were good things about it as well.
Yeah, no doubt. But it was falling apart and was kind of doomed to failure for a couple of reasons, for a myriad of reasons. But
okay, let's do this. Scoop and toss. Why were you all bent out of shape when you walked
into the studio? Because it's the same BS we've been dealing with this mayor of this city,
Chicago,
Rahm Emanuel, for all these years. There's no serious attention to this budget. So we borrow money, and the latest round of borrowing, again, with bonds that are, what, at junk, below junk, around junk?
I don't think we're below junk.
Well, we're not junk yet.
Okay, well... Okay, well,
so we got that going for
let's
us.
Let's be proud. Just a tick above junk. And they just make this loan to pay their bills. And the interest rates are going to pay on this thing is $1 billion. That's $1 billion not going to schools, police, you know, sanitation. None of it's a, it's going to facilitate a yet another loan, another scoop and toss. And
yeah, let me read a sentence from the story on the front page of the Tribune today. And all taxpayers are on the hook for $1.1 billion in interest on the loan, which will cost $2.3 billion to repay over 20 years. $2.3 billion.
Yeah, I mean, this is our kids. We're just like lobbying, and this is on top of a lot of other debt that this mayor has lobbed on us and on our kids and on our kids' kids and our kids' 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 kids.
There are times when borrowing makes sense when you can get favorable interest rates to pay back on loans and money that's outstanding where you're paying higher interest rates. And the state's done this, and occasionally I'll have to defend this to be like, yeah, hey, we're borrowing money at this rate because we're having to pay it back now at a higher rate. This is not one of those situations. No. This is just simply, as far as I read the story, just a kick in the can down the road. Like, we don't want to deal with the urgencies of paying these bills. We're going to need to fill these holes now. We'll let the next mayor, we'll let the next generation deal with this problem. And it's really irresponsible, but it is the result of decades of irresponsibility in this area.
Finally, our recommendations for the week, and they are what? Who wants to go first?
Oh, goodness.
I'll go first. I'm going to recommend an article in The Atlantic called This Article Won't Change Your Mind by Julie Beck. It's online right now. The date is March 13th, 2017. And it just talks about how difficult it is for people to change their minds and how difficult it is to change someone's mind. That when you hear facts that go against your point of view, you have this almost instinctual tendency to double down, to be even more firm in your belief. And it's a long, fascinating, and very depressing article. But I recommend it because I have this thing where I'm like, it baffles me sometimes. How can people like stand by Donald Trump when he's all these things? Like, why aren't they distancing themselves from him? And it's because once you have thrown your lot in with this guy, it's going to be really hard to pry yourself away from him. And I'm, you know, I guess the same is true on the left as well. People who threw in with Obama had a hard time. And it's discouraging for those of us who try to shape opinion for a living. So
how about you, Steve?
I think you should read the article from Eric and become depressed, put it away, get on your couch, turn on your TV, and just pick one game this weekend.
Yeah.
Just pick one. Yeah. And you don't have to watch them all.
Yep.
And put the world behind you and take in college basketball. Mm.
UCLA is going to win it all, I think. That's my pick.
Don't add any stress to it. We're just watching for fun.
That's right. Just let it flow.
Yeah, just be.
Has anyone filled out a bracket?
Oh, yeah.
I haven't. So let me. Who's going to win, John?
I think UCLA is probably
UCLA?
The most exciting team out there.
North Carolina.
How about you, Mr. Stannis? What's your recommendation?
Okay, after you're done with that, then
Who are you picking?
You know, I can't. I'm trying to think now. I think I picked Villanova.
I'd go with Gonzaga if I had to pick a team. But I'm rooting for Michigan.
I think Gonzaga will be the first one seed to lose in the first round.
They always are, right?
We're about to find out.
They're going to lose to Northwestern.
That'd be second round. The Northwestern would be the second round.
I think Gonzaga is going to lose in the first round. A 16 beats the one for the first time ever.
No, that's not going to happen. But they might lose to Northwestern. Northwestern, you never know with that team.
So after all this fun, I wanted to press you again. And this is an older recording, but it's wonderful. It's the choir of St. John's College, and it's Mesere Me, which is a choral arrangement just a few years after Gregorian chants. And it's just haunting and beautiful and lovely. It's all in Latin, so if you don't know what they're saying, it won't depress you. If you do, dang. But
really, it's a bummer otherwise.
Well, Mesere Me is one of the most beautiful choral pieces ever written, in my view.
Scott has really interesting taste in music. I have to say, he'll come into my office and play me something.
Yeah, I came up with some French pop music
really
the other day.
Interesting
a few months ago.
Well, my recommendation is The Art of Fielding. I don't remember the author. Have you read that book yet?
Sounds familiar, but
The Art of Fielding. And it's a fiction, and it's a work, a story about a young boy who's in high school, and he's playing a high school baseball game one day, and one of the kids on the other team says, "Wow, you're good. Come to school with me." He goes to college, and it's that coming of age kind of telling of the story of this young man and this team and so forth. But the writing about the game and the craft of baseball, about the art of fielding, is really good. So I haven't finished the book yet, so maybe I'm not representing it fully as well as I should, but I'm loving it right now.
Chad Harbaugh.
H-A-R-B-A-C-H. Yeah, The Art of Fielding. Okay, we'll see how right and wrong we were on our picks and everything else we've just said. We will post another podcast on you this week. Thank you, Eric Zorn, Scott Stannis, Steve Bertrand. Our engineer I'm looking at is Ben Cortez.
So great to have John in the studio.
I'm in the studio. And there's our producer, Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNradio.com. Just click on the WGN Plus tab. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus Podcast Network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!